The Sioux nomads passed out of sight by climbing over the bluffs. They might steal horses or kill Hidatsa and were themselves subject to attack. The Mayenga of New Guinea asserted, "We marry the people we fight." But the notion that war arises, basically, from ignorance and provincialism, has persisted, because it is in many ways an optimistic one. If war represents a failure to recognize human diversity, then all we have to do to end it is to learn to see through the local variations in language, culture, religion, and so forth, and rediscover our common humanity. In this view, the flaw that leads humans into war is not a moral, but a cognitive one, and can be cured through the kind of education that engenders an enlightened tolerance of human differences. Now, from the point of view of any particular side in any particular war, the enemy may indeed be seen as a repulsively different other. But the differences are often almost imperceptible to an outsider, as between Protestant and Catholic Irish people, for example, or Serbs and Croats, or one sub-tribe of Yanomamo Indians and another. And over time, they will be overshadowed by the common and overarching imperatives of war. Certainly, this is true at the level of technology, where failure to mimic the enemy can be fatal. An American commentator observed of the Cold War, "All things communist remain anathema, but the slightest word of some new development in Russia is sufficient to set in motion investigations by several congressional committees and private foundations to find out why we are not doing the same thing." But the symmetry between enemies goes beyond the instruments of war. During the Cold War, the ostensibly democratic United States developed the permanent bureaucracy of the national security state, parallel to that of the Soviets, and including government agencies dedicated to rooting out and suppressing domestic dissent. In general, as Israeli military historian Martin von Krefeld explains, given time, the fighting itself will cause the two sides to become more like each other, even to the point where opposites converge, merge, and change places. The principal reason behind this phenomenon is that war represents perhaps the most imitative activity known to man. There is a mechanism, almost a human reflex, that guarantees that belligerents will in fact be given time for this convergence to occur. And that mechanism is revenge. A raid or attack or insult must be matched with an attack of equal or greater destructive force. One atrocity will be followed by another, and no matter how amicable the two sides may once have been, they will soon be locked together in a process from which no escape seems possible. To the warrior, the necessity of revenge may be self-evident and beyond appeal. The Hebrew-Indian is wholly penetrated by the idea of retaliation. His desire for revenge is an expression of his sense of justice. If one reprehends a Hebrew because he has killed an enemy, his answer is generally, he has killed himself. The necessity of revenge may well be another legacy of our animal fighting, prehistoric past. Revenge has a pedagogical purpose, whether the enemy is animal or human. It teaches the intruder to stay away. Conversely, the creature that does not fight back marks itself as prey. At the Paleolithic kill sites where early humans battled competing scavengers, some version of revenge may have been essential to establishing the human claim to meat. Like modern dogs, canine intruders could have been taught to keep their distance by being struck or stoned. Similarly, many wild predators have learned that the price of human meat can be gunshots, spear wounds, or fiery sticks waved in their faces. And they seem to have passed the lesson along to their young. In the face of non-human enemies, retaliation makes sense. The animals will not counter-retaliate at some later time, but, being sensible, will slink away. But no matter how often we are told that some human enemy must be taught a lesson, the impulse to revenge is by no means entirely rational. In traditional societies, wars may be started for no other purpose than to overcome grief. The Kwakiutl of the Pacific Northwest often followed up natural deaths with retaliatory headhunting raids. The dead relative might equally have died in bed of disease or by the hand of an enemy. The headhunting was called killing, to wipe one's eyes. And it was a means of getting even by making another household mourn instead. Among South American Indians living near the Putumayo River, even damage caused by a thunderstorm could be an excuse for a retaliatory raid, since every ill that befalls a man they set down to the evil intent of an enemy. Similarly, the Mianmen of New Guinea lacked the concept of a natural death, so that all adult deaths were viewed as political acts carried out by the enemy. Every death, then, was an insult, which had to be avenged by going to war. After a period of mourning, marked by violence and brawls, the hamlet may be abandoned, as if the survivors of the deceased were war refugees, and/or retaliatory attacks on other hamlets, on whom blame has been assigned by ritual. Grief, depression, helplessness. These are the experiences of prey. The obvious way out, the way our species learned through a million years of conflict with larger and stronger animals, is to assume the stance of the predator, turn grief to rage, go from listless mourning to the bustling preparations for offensive attack. This, more or less, is what Achilles does in the Iliad. He recovers from the paralysis of hurt feelings and grief through his spectacular revenge for Patroclus's death. Animals secure in their predator status know nothing of revenge. But humans are hardly secure. Our triumph over the other species occurred not that long ago. And childhood, for each of us, recapitulates the helplessness of prey. For purely emotional reasons, then, human antagonists readily find themselves caught up in the well-known cycle of violence, taking turns as prey and predator, matching injury with injury, bound together as powerfully as lovers in their bed. The dance of action and reaction engenders a symmetry between belligerents which warriors recognize and sometimes consciously enhance. To defeat an enemy, you must know that enemy and learn to think as he thinks. Before Achilles can kill Hector, he must become as much like him as possible, spending books 18 to 20 of the Iliad mimicking him and usurping his identity as a hunter. Conversely, if someone is so truly and incomprehensibly different as to be subhuman, in the sense Ruth Benedict suggests, he may never achieve the status of a genuine enemy. 19th-century European aristocrats refused to duel with their social inferiors. Nor did Europeans always bother to dignify their campaigns against indigenous peoples with the word war. The clashes of British against French, or French against Prussian, were wars, recalled with definite names and dates. But, with a few exceptions like the Zulu Wars, their fiercely resisted incursions against Africans and Asians tend to be lumped together indiscriminately under bloodless phrases like imperialist expansion. At the level of the individual, the symmetry of war may even be expressed as a kind of love. Enemies, by definition, hate each other. But between habitual and well-matched enemies, an entirely different feeling may arise. Sometimes this love is reserved for the trophies created from the bodies of dead enemies, their shrunken heads or scalps. The scalp of an enemy was of remarkable importance for the Kokopo warrior. He brought the object back with him and soon retired to a place isolated from other people, where he spent several nights and days in communion with the scalp. During that time, it talked to him, especially at night, telling him how to be a great warrior and giving him special powers. Or the dead enemy may be incorporated by his killer's tribe as a kind of honorary kinsman. The practice of naming a child after a particularly valiant enemy was once widespread, from New Guinea to the North American plains. Genghis Khan's birth name, for example, was Temujin, taken from a tribal enemy his father had vanquished and captured. There have been, in some instances, ritual occasions for the face-to-face expression of love between enemy combatants. When an Aztec warrior subdued an opponent in battle, he formally reassured his prisoner that he would not be eaten, and considered his captive as his own flesh and blood, calling him son, while the latter called him father. Or consider what Richard Barber, the historian of medieval European knighthood, called the curious custom of fighting in mines. The besiegers of a fortress often dug mines under the fortress walls. The besieged would dig countermines in order to get out and harass the besiegers. If a mine met a countermine, a fight might ensue, conducted by torchlight and according to the rules of the tournament. The odd part is that, merely by participating in this underground combat, enemy knights were transformed into brothers in arms, meaning that their personal enmity was dissolved, and they were henceforth bound to one another in such a way that each will stand by the other, to the death if need be. The symmetry forged by war echoes the peculiar symmetries often found in sacrificial rites. In Aztec ritual, the sacrificial victim was sometimes dressed to impersonate the god or goddess who was the intended recipient of the sacrifice. In Christian imagery, which reflects far earlier traditions, Jesus is both the sacrificial lamb and, through the mystery of the Trinity, the deity to whom the lamb is offered. Hubert and Mauss noted the extreme and complicated doubling in ancient Greek sacrificial rites. The great Dorian festival of the Carnia, for example, celebrated in honor of Apollo Carneos, was supposedly instituted to expiate the sacrificial killing of the soothsayer Carnos, who is himself Apollo Carneos. These symmetries may reflect humankind's primordial experience of being both prey and predator, an experience faithfully recreated in every battle. War, then, is not simply a clash of others, made possible by an ignorant horror of difference. The warrior looks out at the enemy and sees men who are, in crucial respects, recognizably like himself. They are warriors too, and whatever differences they may have, whatever long-standing reasons for hatred, they share the basic tenets of warriordom: a respect for courage, a willingness to stand by one's comrades no matter what, a bold indifference to death. Even when divided by race and vast cultural differences, enemies may admire each other for their conduct as warriors. To the medieval European crusaders, for example, the enemy was not a priori an object of hatred. The Saracen, strong, brave, and fierce, and always vanquished in the end, was the ideal adversary in the medieval warrior's imagination. More ambivalently, a British colonel wrote of the West African Asantes he had helped to defeat, "It was impossible not to admire the gallantry of these savages." In a sense, warriors everywhere constitute a tribe unto themselves, transcending all other tribes and nations. Certainly, and especially in our own time, warring cultures have sought to magnify their differences for propagandistic reasons. Witness the demonization of the Huns, Japs, and Gooks Americans have fought against. But at the same time, as Schmuckler observed, war also works to flatten out many of the differences of culture, if not, of course, of race or language, that distinguish tribes and nations. Trade does this too, imposing similar tastes and fashions on people who may share little else. But war does it in a highly specific way. For one thing, the concentration of the weapons and prestige of war in the hands of men reinforces male supremacy, which is in itself a nearly universal characteristic of human societies. certain common patterns of gender relations have been observed, for example, among warlike, small-scale horticultural societies, whether they are in the Amazon basin, New Guinea, or parts of Africa. In these societies, women are valued largely as prizes of war, or as prestigious possessions accorded to victorious warriors, and have little or no voice in group decision-making. As anthropologist William T. DeValley observes, primitive warfare is part of a syndrome which also includes female infanticide, polygyny, and marriage alliances. The almost universal occurrence of this syndrome in primitive cultures, plus its important ecological role, has led to the conclusion that the syndrome constitutes the basic structural framework or template of primitive social organization. In addition, the maintenance of warriors itself imposes certain disciplines and forms of organization. Weapons must be manufactured, sometimes out of raw materials gathered from distant sites, and potential warriors must be instructed in their use. The use of metal weaponry, in particular, demands a complex division of labor, and, usually, a centralized command system to coordinate the mining and transport of ore, and the manufacture of the weapons. In the ancient world, the imperatives of weapons manufacture and warrior maintenance often went along with despotism and the formation of highly centralized dynastic states. But not always. The ancient Greeks fought on foot, in a phalanx formation that stressed equality and interdependence. And, as historian Victor Hansen has convincingly argued, this mode of warfare was compatible with the limited democracy of the city-state. In general, the early 20th century sociologist Stanisław Andrzejewski argued, militarism has a decisive influence on forms of political organization. But whether it favors democracy or despotism depends on the particular mode of warfare practiced. So, there is no single cultural pattern stamped by war on all human societies, everywhere and at all times. We can say, though, that similar technologies and styles of warfare place similar demands on human cultures, and that these demands tend to impose a kind of sameness in areas of social endeavor that are seemingly remote from the business of war. Contrary to Marx, it is not only the means of production that shape human societies, but the means of destruction. And for much of human history, the means of destruction have favored societies ruled by warriors themselves. 9. The warrior elite. Do you not know that I live by war, and that peace would be my undoing? Sir John Hawkwood, English Free Company captain during the Hundred Years' War. Nothing more clearly illustrates the power of war as a culture-shaping force than the eerie parallels between feudal Japan and feudal Europe. Both societies rested on the labor of relatively unfree peasants, and both were ruled by hereditary warrior classes, knights in Europe, and bushi, or samurai, in Japan, representing, or at least serving, the landed aristocracy. If, through some magical transposition, a medieval knight and a samurai had met on the same road, they would have immediately recognized each other as kin. Both wore helmets and armor, fought on horseback, rallied to flags emblazoned with dynastic symbols or totems, invested their swords with mystic power, and subscribed to a special warrior ethic, chivalry in Europe, bushido in Japan, which codified, for its adherents, a kind of religion of war. In her study of the bushi tradition, Katerina Blomberg lists these parallels, only to dismiss them as entirely fortuitous, since, after all, there had been no contact between medieval Europe and Japan. What she misses is the entirely unfortuitous effect of the means of destruction which these two cultures shared. Both employed metal blades to cut human flesh and horses to transport warriors to and about the battlefield. This technology leads to, and even seems to require, the kind of social arrangement we know as feudalism, which has been defined as an essentially military type of social organization designed to produce and support cavalry. A very similar pattern emerged in pre-colonial Western Africa, a social and economic elite of mounted knight-like warriors, subscribing to a quasi-religious warrior ethic. The knight and the samurai are, in some ways, special cases, preferring, as they did, to fight at close range with their cherished swords. Other warriors of the pre-gun era, no less proud and individualistic, fought from a distance with metal-tipped arrows propelled by compound bows. The European knight was again and again shocked to encounter, during the Crusades and the various incursions of nomadic Asian hordes, highly skilled mounted warriors, who announced their attacks with a hail of arrows and used their bladed weapons primarily to dispatch the wounded. But all, swordsmen and archers alike, were part of a system of warfare that depended on the synergy of metal and muscle. The metal could be worked to a point as an arrow tip or pounded to a cutting edge as a sword. The muscle could be that of the human arm alone, or that of the arm reinforced by the speed and strength of the horse. Either way, the metal and muscle approach to warfare imposed certain common themes on the cultures that engaged in it, whether they did so reluctantly or with zest. The most obvious and fundamental commonality was that the metal-bearing warrior depended on the labor of other non-warrior men. In small-scale horticultural societies, such as those of New Guinea or the Amazon Valley, all men are warriors, and the induction to warrior status coincides with the male initiation rite to which all boys are subjected. To be a man, a real man, is to be a warrior. Ideally, the two conditions are indistinguishable. But as the tools of war evolve and become more costly, warrior status narrows to an elite, set off from other men as well as women. The Yanomamo warrior made his own weapons and required no underclass, beyond that represented by his wives, to do his planting and hoeing and cooking. Behind each knight or samurai, however, or, for that matter, each mounted archer, stood a small army of food-producing peasants of both sexes, plus grooms and other servants, as well as miners and craftsmen to manufacture his weapons and armor. For more than 5,000 years, from the beginning of recorded history to AD 1500, and over a huge geographical range, the means of destruction centered on this combination of metal and muscle. Bronze weapons and armor first appeared in Mesopotamia at about 3500 BC, and cheaper iron weapons came into use about 1300 years later. Horses made their battlefield debut early in the second millennium BC, pulling sturdy chariots from which men shot arrows and hurled spears. Within a few centuries, the metal and muscle-based means of destruction had spread south to northern Africa, west to Europe, and eastward to India, China, and Japan. Lacking horses and the appropriate metals, the warring Mesoamerican civilizations depended on obsidian weapons, wielded by men on foot. But obsidian, no less than iron or copper and tin for bronze, had to be mined, transported, and worked into shape by loyal underlings. There were two possible ways for warrior groups to resolve the problem of their dependence on large numbers of other men. One is represented by stratified societies, in which a warrior elite is supported by a non-warrior class, or classes, and in return, undertakes to protect this subpopulation from the incursions of other warrior groups, an arrangement often described, roughly speaking, as civilization. Alternatively, the warrior group might not bother to maintain or protect its own laboring class and sources of materials. It might live off the land, fulfilling its needs through constant raids and conquests. That is, armed robbery. This approach, utilized by the nomadic fighters who repeatedly harassed settled agricultural communities in both ancient and medieval times, was generally seen by civilized people as a kind of barbarianism. The Mongol warriors, who fought under Genghis Khan, for example, had little need for a permanently subjugated population to support them. In many ways, they constituted one of the most self-sufficient armies ever fielded. Their tough little mares were not only a means of transportation, but a source of food, in the form of milk. And unlike the larger horses that bore the weight of armored knights, the Mongol horses grazed on the grass around them, even grass buried under snow, and needed no supplies of special fodder. But for anything else, such as the metal parts of his weaponry, as well as luxuries like bread and wine, the Mongol warrior was utterly dependent on the people whose towns and farms he burned and sacked. The difference between the civilized and the barbarian approach to warfare was clearly not as great as practitioners of the former liked to think. Although the warrior within a settled society might not extort every meal at sword or spear point, his dominance over the mass of toiling underlings who grew his food and forged his weapons was maintained, ultimately, by force. The exact causal links between the rise of large-scale warfare and the emergence of class societies are still a subject for debate. But it seems unlikely that large numbers of people would submit to lifelong labor on limited rations unless inspired, now and then, by the threat of death. At least we can say, echoing Andreevsky, that the means of destruction employed in war have again and again done service as the means of domestic repression. Thus, a certain brutal logic underlies the civilized warring states of the ancient and medieval worlds. The warrior depends for his superior weapons, among other things, on the labor of others. And at the same time, it is his weaponry that enables him to exploit the labor of others. No mob of peasants armed with pitchforks could, for example, hope to topple the armored and mounted knight, who could mow them down with his lance or hack them from on high with his sword. Such a commanding figure must be treated with deference, even with the abject obeisance otherwise reserved for gods. In feudal Japan, a commoner encountering a samurai on the road was expected to dismount, bow deeply with his eyes averted, and pray that he would not become a victim of tsuchigiri, or crossroads cutting, in which a samurai would use some random common person as material on which to test his sword blade. There is another way, too, in which the civilized warrior resembled the barbarian raider. The lower class, on whose labor he depended, was very often made up of people different from himself in language and culture, people whose own warrior elite had been previously defeated in war. While the nomadic warrior preyed briefly on each set of victims, looting, destroying, and then moving on, his settled counterpart might prey on the same subjugated people for generations, even eventually becoming genetically intermixed with them. In one stratified society after another, the lower class turns out to be composed wholly, or partly, of a defeated people or their descendants, ethnically different from the ruling class. The Messenians within Sparta, Israelites within Egypt, Gallic peoples within Roman Europe, African agriculturalists within kingdoms ruled by the descendants of conquering Hamitic pastoralists, Saxons within Norman England. Thus, class divisions have been, in many settings, a product of war. From the point of view of the common people, the civilized warrior might be almost as much a foreign enemy to his own people as was the dreaded nomad raider from the hinterlands. But at the deepest level, the resemblance between the free-ranging barbarian warrior and his civilized counterpart can best be expressed with a biological metaphor. Both were predators on human life and culture. Historian William H. McNeil describes warrior elites as macroparasites, analogous to microparasites like bacteria and viruses, and offers the example of the 3rd millennium BC Mesopotamian king, Sargon, who maintained his army of 5,400 men by constant predation on the surrounding countryside. To keep such a force in being also required annual campaigning, devastating one fertile landscape after another in order to keep the soldiers in victuals. Costs to the population at large were obviously very great. Indeed, Sargon's armies can well be compared to the ravages of an epidemic disease that kills a significant proportion of the host population, yet, by its very passage, confers an immunity lasting for several years. The elite warrior must be fed, and, in part, because of the bursts of muscular energy required by his way of fighting, fed far better than those who grow the grain. He must be clothed and quartered somewhere. His horses, too, if he possesses them, must be fed and quartered and groomed. But he himself neither sows nor reaps, and from the vantage point of the ordinary people, he can be counted on to be a producer of only ruin and death. Cretan warriors from the 9th century BC sang, proudly, we may imagine, or perhaps with a wink, my wealth is spear and sword, and the stout shield which protects my flesh. With this I plow, with this I reap, with this I tread the sweet wine from the grape. With this I am entitled master of the serfs. Sometimes the elite warrior understood his predatory relationship to the rest of humankind, and may even have felt a vague unease on account of it. In his book, The Gods of the Warrior, Rick Fields quotes the 17th century philosopher samurai, Yamaga Soko, as wondering, the samurai eats food without growing it, uses utensils without manufacturing them, and profits without buying or selling. What is the justification for this? But Yamaga Soko quickly answers himself. The business of the samurai consists in reflecting on his own station in life, on discharging loyal service to his master, if he has one, in deepening his fidelity in associations with friends, and in devoting himself to duty, above all. The samurai deserved his special status, in other words, because he was a samurai, and ultimately needed no more justification for his predations than, say, a wolf or lion would. In fact, the elite warrior epitomized the human status as predator. He must even have looked to his fellow humans like a member of some far better endowed species. His horse gave him superhuman height. His armor acted as a glittering exoskeleton, from which bladed weapons protruded like tusks or claws, while his heraldry might announce his kinship with lions, leopards, eagles, or other threatening animals. Fictive families. If war itself is thought of as something other than human, an abstract system that is alive in some formal mathematical sense and preys on human societies, then warrior elites are the human form it takes. Through much of history, it is they, and not the mass of ordinary people, who have made war, sought war, and celebrated war as a heroic and even religious undertaking. To the non-warrior, the peasants, for example, who so often found themselves in the way of thundering warrior hosts, war can be a catastrophe on the scale of plague or famine. To the warrior, though, it is the very condition of life, of a good life anyway, which women and peasants can never fully share. In war, he finds adventure, camaraderie, searing extremes of emotion, proof of manhood, possibly new territory and loot, and always the chance of a glorious death, meaning not death at all, but everlasting fame. In between wars, he keeps the memory of these things alive with recited epics and chansons de geste, reenacts them as duel or tournament, and celebrates them in warlike pageantry. Elite warriors going back to ancient times would have felt well represented by the words of a young German Freikorpsman, who wrote, shortly after World War I, "People told us that the war was over. That made us laugh. We ourselves are the war." In generalizing about warrior elites, we are, of course, gliding recklessly over vast cultural differences and historical changes. Within the European tradition alone, the notion of a warrior elite embraces both the rough-and-tumble men-at-arms of the early Middle Ages and the dandified aristocrats of a much later time. It includes the knight, who fought in a more or less undisciplined, individualistic manner, as well as the officer, within a huge bureaucratized army, who may never have fought at all, but commanded scores of lesser men to do so. It includes mercenaries, who fought for whatever prince could pay their fee, as well as idealists, who fought for their god, or later, nation. It includes, too, men who would hardly seem to qualify as members of an elite. Poor knights, second sons forced off the ancestral land by primogeniture. Men like Don Quixote, for example, who were sometimes little more than beggars bearing arms. If there is any excuse for generalizing about warrior elites, it is that they themselves have freely done so. Their members have again and again understood themselves to be part of one long, unbroken tradition, linking father to son, and more generally, the fighting men of one time to those of another. In their own minds, they form a special kind of lineage, of which General Douglas MacArthur's famous image of a long gray line of West Point alumni is one fragmentary example, stretching back thousands of years. It is from this notion of lineage that the warrior derived his most exalted and mystic sense of who he was, not merely a mortal individual born of woman, but a link within a far superior tradition, analogous to a priesthood, and composed exclusively of men, meaning often only noble men. Charioteers and mounted fighters were the founding patriarchs of the lineage, and the mystique, or romance of war, still reverberates with their hoofbeats, clashing blades, and hissing storms of arrows and hurled spears. Well into the era of the gun, when chemical energy had decisively replaced the power of human and eventually even equine muscle, warriors clung to the spirit and even the paraphernalia of the pre-gun era. Civil War General Stonewall Jackson ordered 1,000 pikes, the medieval weapons, for his men. Whether they were delivered or not, I do not know, but they would hardly have been an effective defense against Union artillery. The European officer corps entered the First World War expecting to fight on horseback and made only a slow and grudging adaptation to motor vehicles. Similarly, metal blades, except for bayonets, were abandoned only recently and with much sorrow and ceremony. In World War II, General George Patton claimed that the saddest moment in his life came when he stood at attention, weeping, as his cavalry regiment marched past to stack their sabers for the last time. In the mind of the warrior, the idea of a warrior lineage stretching back thousands of years is hardly an abstraction. Certainly it was very real to Patton. His family featured generations of distinguished military men. His childhood heroes included Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. He believed he was the reincarnation of dead heroes, both Confederate and Viking. At a visit to a Civil War battleground sometime in the 1920s, he got into an argument about where exactly a certain general had been standing. The argument was resolved by an elderly veteran who claimed to have participated in the battle as a boy. "Yes," Patton responded, "I was here too." Patton may be an extreme case, but elite warriors are generally encouraged to locate themselves within a transnational warrior lineage. West Point's Washington Hall confronts the cadets with a giant mural depicting more than 2 millennia of military exploits in a mass of spears, arrows, muskets, gas masks, siege engines, and elephants. Cyrus at Babylon, William at Hastings, Meade at Gettysburg, Joffre at the Marne. Where the tradition is historically vague or insufficiently uplifting, imagination has filled in. 19th-century Prussians, for example, saw themselves as the successors of the Spartans and the Assyrians, or rooted their pedigree in medieval times, sometimes describing themselves as crusaders. Medieval knights, in turn, sought roots in ancient times, through a 12th-century genre of romances, which described the heroes of the Trojan War as if they were medieval knights themselves, complete with suits of armor. Addressing the cadets at West Point, General MacArthur conjured up a ghostly succession of American warriors, who were to serve as the superegos of the young. Were the cadets ever to fail in their duty, a million ghosts in olive drab, in brown khaki, in blue and gray, would rise from their white crosses, thundering those magic words, duty, honor, country. For imaginative reach, though, no one has matched the German national science of Aryanology, which sought to trace the Wehrmacht's ethnic and spiritual lineage back thousands of years to the prehistoric Indo-European armed male band, or Männerbund. These pseudo-scholarly efforts to construct a continuous bloodline of German Aryan warriors no doubt played a role in Hitler's conception of himself as a member of a race of Aryan godmen. There has been, at various times and places, a real basis for the warrior's notion of a warrior lineage. Metal and muscle technology tended to favor a hereditary warrior elite, with warrior status passed on from father to son, largely because of the cost of equipping each fighting man, especially if he required armor and horses. In medieval Europe, for example, a single knight's equipment was worth the equivalent of about 20 oxen, or the plow teams of 10 peasant families. Thus, warriors had to be wealthy, compared with average people, or in the case of mercenaries employed by wealthy men. And wealth took the form of land, which was inherited through the blood lineage, or noble family. Many acres of land, cultivated by peasants, were required to maintain a noble household with its core of knights and squires. Conversely, the extreme social inequality characterizing feudalism could be maintained only by employing armed force from time to time against the resentful peasantry. Feudal aristocracy existed by war and for war, Toynbee wrote. Its power had been founded by arms, and by arms that power was maintained. Much of Europe's warrior elite persisted as an unbroken bloodline for centuries, well into the age of guns. To take the case of Prussia, a warrior society par excellence. As late as 1871, 96% of officers promoted to the rank of brigadier general were from the landed nobility. By 1914, 58% were still men of the landed aristocracy, almost half of them holding titles that dated back to before 1400. Similarly, the pre-World War I British officer corps was rooted in the landed aristocracy, a regimental position being one of the few occupations deemed suitable for a young man of relative wealth and leisure. Thus, right up into the 20th century, armies have been led disproportionately by men whose surnames include the Du or Von of feudal entitlement, whose male relatives had led armies before them, and who took up the sword or gun as a matter, more or less, of birthright. A lineage of men. But there is a problem with hereditary lineages based on real blood ties. They consist, by necessity, of two sexes. In the era of muscle-based fighting, few women could have hoped to achieve warrior status, even if custom had not frowned upon such unwomanly aspirations. They had little to contribute, from a warrior's point of view, except wombs, in which to incubate the next generation of fighting men. According to anthropologist Nancy Jay, the patriarchal imagination has long sought to expunge any other female contribution and construct a lineage of men alone. In Aeschylus's play The Furies, to take a particularly clear-cut example, the young, modem, Olympian gods Apollo and Athena argue that mothers are not truly parents, but only vessels for the father's seed. In the Bible, the long lists of begats link male names alone, with only an occasional, almost parenthetical reference to a mother, wife, or sister. Similarly, medieval knights and samurai entered battle prepared to announce their noble antecedents to all potential combatants. But these recitations would normally have included only male names. The suppression of women within warrior elites goes beyond the usual patriarchal imperative of ensuring the orderly transmission of property from father to son. Within warrior elites, marriage was usually politically motivated and used as a means of building alliances between sometimes hostile clans or states. Thus, a bride entered her husband's household as a representative of an erstwhile or potential enemy group. She might, in fact, be treated as an enemy herself, as in this unsettling tale from anthropologist June Nash's study of gender relations among the pre-contact Mexicans. Shortly after the Aztecs arrived in Chapultepec, the Aztecs asked the chief of the Calhuacans, Coxcox, for his daughter in marriage to their chief. According to the Ramirez Codex, the god Huitzilopochtli declared that she should be sacrificed. Her father was invited to the wedding party, but was appalled when he went into the chamber and found the priest dressed in his daughter's skin. This was an attempt both to assert and to validate the combative stance of the Aztecs in the heavily populated valley where they had chosen to live. Or a bride might choose to act as an enemy, a kind of fifth column within her husband's household. Japanese history is filled with stories of loyal daughters serving as treasonous wives or vice versa, brides who were expected to spy on their new family, or who were used by their husbands to carry disinformation back to their fathers and brothers. An aphorism attributed to the 16th century daimyo, samurai lord, Taikido Shingen, advised that even when husband and wife are alone together, he should never forget his dagger. Nothing, though, underscores the dilemma of the woman within a warrior elite as strikingly as the myth of the Princess Signy in the Norse saga of the Volsungs. Forced by her father to marry a hostile king, Sigir, she bears him two sons, but she knows them to be potential enemies who might eventually battle her own father and brothers. So, ever the good daughter, Signy arranges for her sons to be killed by her brother. Then, with the help of a sorceress, she assumes a new shape, sleeps with her brother, and bears a son she can finally love. The hero, Sinfjotli. If the solution seems drastic, so too was the problem. Exogamy, the requirement that one marry outside one's own immediate clan or bloodline, too often condemned a woman to life behind enemy lines. The untrustworthiness of women as wives limited even the role they could play as mothers. In any case, practically speaking, warriors are made, not born. And the making of new warriors has been an exclusively male business, a form of reproduction in which women play no part at all. In medieval Europe, boys of noble family were taken from their mothers at the age of about 7 to begin their training as pages and then as squires. When a young man was ready to be girded with the sword or initiated into knighthood, his father did the honors, until sometime in the 12th century when the church took on this role. In the samurai's initiation rite of Genbuko, performed at age 15 or 16, an older male relative placed the boy's formal bushi robes on him. To the extent that initiation rites represent a rebirth, as much ethnography suggests, it is a rebirth to males, obliterating the earlier biological birth from a woman's body. But whatever ceremonies take place in moments of peace, the warrior's true rite of initiation can only be battle itself. And this has been, almost universally, the exclusive business of men. Through his first kill, a young man earns his spurs, bloods his spear, or even, as was said by Americans in Vietnam, loses his virginity, thus marking his rebirth into the world of grown-up men. Informed that his son was hard-pressed by the French at the Battle of Crécy, King Edward III refused to send him reinforcements, commanding that the English nobles let the boy win his spurs. Thus, the chronicler Jean Froissart implies, did a loving father ensure his son's ascent to warrior status? Some men are so altered by the experience of battle that they can never again be at ease in the mundane world, which women also inhabit. They will become permanent warriors. Crusaders, who on returning from the Holy Land devoted themselves to battling European heretics. English knights, who refused to stop fighting during truces in the Hundred Years' War, but remained in France as freebooting marauders. Civil War veterans, who left the battlefields of the American East to battle Indians in the West. German officers, who after the First World War led the reactionary Freikorps that terrorized the German working class, and who went on to form the core of Hitler's brown-shirted stormtroopers, the SA. In our own time, too, the laid-off warrior can be a constant menace, often to his own people as well as to his erstwhile enemies. Afghani men, inducted into warriorhood during their nation's war with the Soviet Union, stalk the world's supply of Islamic terrorists. American veterans of recent wars have found ways to extend their warrior days by joining right-wing militias and, in a few notorious cases, engaging in domestic terrorism. As the German literary scholar Klaus Tavelite's study of the Freikorps men makes clear, a major attraction of their way of life was that it was virtually woman-free. He quotes, for example, from a fascist novel, in which a Freikorps commander is described admiringly as having no idea there are such things as women. War is not the only way, of course, that men have sought to create lineages free of women. Priesthoods and certain professions or crafts have often served the same function, with skills and lore being passed from one generation of males to the next, often through special ceremonies of initiation. Property, too, has usually been transmitted from man to man. And, according to Jay, one function of blood sacrifice in ancient religions was to define, through ritual, the male-only lineage required for inheritance. What is needed to provide clear evidence of social and religious paternity is an act as definite and available to the senses as childbirth. In her account, this act was sacrifice, with the right to participate in the sacrifice marking the boundaries of true kin for the purposes of inheritance. Sacrificing, she wrote, produces and reproduces forms of intergenerational continuity generated by males, transmitted by males, and transcending community through women. Or, to quote a Hindu text, the Maitrayani Samhita, in truth, man is unborn. It is through sacrifice that he is born. Jay died at the peak of her career, but if she had lived to consider the post-sacrificial era, she would no doubt have observed that the rite that eventually came to define an elite male lineage was not the slaughter of animals at the altar, but the slaughter of men in war. The battle itself has often been conceived as one great sacrificial action, according to classicist Walter Burkert, with the mounds of the dead sometimes serving as the meat meant to feed the gods. Among some ancient northern European tribes, the dead of both sides were viewed as sacrificial offerings, and the ravens who ate them were seen as representatives of the deity to whom the sacrifice was offered. In the oldest Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, the final battle becomes a sacrificial ritual presided over by the god Krishna. Trembling and quivering, they were slain like animals in a sacrifice. If battle is a kind of sacrifice, and sacrifice is, according to Jay, a kind of birth, we can infer that battle has served at times as a peculiar means of reproduction. Battle makes a warrior out of a boy, and his rebirth as a warrior, no less than his original birth, is marked by the shedding of blood. In extreme, or perhaps ideal, cases, warriors dispense with biology altogether and reproduce themselves entirely through the mechanism of war. The Janissary armies that fought for Muslim princes in the 14th and 15th centuries were celibate, at least in regard to women, as were the medieval European warrior monks, the Knights Templars, and Knights Hospitallers. Shaka, the 19th century Zulu king and military genius, did not allow his men to marry until they reached middle age and threatened to kill any of his concubines who became pregnant. Such pure and dedicated warriors need no heirs except the young men they initiate through battle, no family but the half-imagined warrior lineage. Warriors make wars, but it is also true that, in what has so far been an endless reproductive cycle, war makes warriors. 10. The Sacralization of War. The soldier of Christ kills safely. He dies the more safely. He serves his own interests in dying, and Christ's interests in killing. Not without cause does he bear the sword. Saint Bernard. Warriors do not come automatically to a transcendent or religious sense of their occupation, any more than do professional chefs or athletes. The only traits universally valued in fighting men are courage and loyalty to one's band or leader. And these values they share with street gangs and organized crime syndicates. Within the limits of acceptable warrior-like behavior, there is plenty of room for bullying and loudishness of all degrees. And not only toward the enemy of the moment. Gilgamesh, the first warrior hero of recorded history, had to be distracted from his predations on his own people, who opened the story by complaining that his arrogance has no bounds by day or night. His lust leaves no virgin to her lover. History offers plenty of warnings about the dangers of underemployed warriors to the civilian population that supports them. In ancient Sparta, young men in Kypreia, or secret male society, honed their warrior skills by going to live secretly in the countryside, emerging at night to kill any helots or serfs they could find. Rape has been endemic wherever warriors rule, and was even legalized in medieval Europe as the feudal lord's droit du seigneur. Knights did not necessarily appear in shining armor, but sometimes in the guise of the predator, like the spectacularly evil Raoul du Cambrai in the chanson of the same name. In the story, Raoul attacks a nunnery, pitches his tent right in the chapel, with his bed at the altar and his hawks mewed to the crucifix, and ends up burning the nuns alive in response to an imagined insult. Similarly bad behavior was not unknown among real-life knights. An early 14th century list of 31 sins common among knights includes pillaging, killing priests, and puffing themselves up with pride. The European warrior elite, perhaps more than any other, was given to drunkenness and brawling, with unpleasant consequences for the civilian population. Evidence for the role of strong drink goes back to prehistoric times. The distinctive beakers left by the mounted warriors who swept through Europe in the 3rd millennium BC contained a flavored version of mead. In early Greece, warrior culture centered on the feast, held in the hall of a warrior leader, and featuring long bouts of drinking and boasting. This tradition was carried on by the medieval knighthood, whose castle hall served as both dining rooms and dormitories for the assembled men-at-arms. Both barracks and barroom, in other words. Wherever knights gathered, there was the possibility of general violence. Tournaments, so stately and elegant in Hollywood depictions, often degenerated into riots, and the church tried vainly to ban them. Even church property was not exempt from the effects of knightly high spirits. The noble participants at the knighting of Louis d'Anjou and his brother Charles at a monastery in 1389 were, according to a contemporary chronicler, driven by drunkenness to all such disorders that several of them sullied the sanctity of the religious house and abandoned themselves to libertinage and adultery. Yet warrior elites, for all their lapses into thuggery, have long sought to make war into something sacred and worthy of general respect. Encouraged, often, by the religious authorities themselves, warrior elites have borrowed all that they could from established religions, ransacking them, as it were, for glorious rationales and colorful fragments of ceremony. Even wars undertaken for no other purpose than loot, or for no purpose at all other than the initiation of a fresh cohort of warriors, achieve a mystic status when fought in the name of the true cross, the Ark of the Covenant, a relic of the Prophet, or the honor of the Fatherland. To the true member of the warrior elite, every war can be a holy one. One of the most direct and obvious ways to sacralize war was to use it as a means of capturing victims for human sacrifice. Here, the Aztecs remain the best-studied example. As a nation of warriors and craftsmen, they were dependent on the peoples they conquered for much of their food, for slaves, and for luxury items like gold and decorative feathers. But the gratification of material needs was apparently not enough, by itself, to justify the Aztecs' perpetual campaigns against their neighbors. What made war seem legitimate and just was its contribution to the religious rite of sacrifice. In Aztec Mexico, as in the 19th century West African kingdoms, which also practiced the ritual sacrifice of war captives, the public sacrifice of war captives advertised military success, and the obligation to provide victims for sacrifice supplied a justification for the waging of war. Historically, war may have gained religious legitimacy in other cultures too, by putting itself in the service of ritual human sacrifice. It is impossible, especially in retrospect, to sort out the religious excuses for war from its other functions, such as the taking of loot, or the perpetuation of a warrior subgroup. The tribute the defeated were required to pay might itself take the form of human sacrificial material. Athens, according to myth, had to send 7 youths and 7 maidens annually to Crete, to be devoured by the Minotaur. And if we ever doubt the human capacity for absolutely disinterested destruction, there were Celtic tribes that, according to the Romans, not only hanged all captured enemies as sacrificial offerings, but killed the enemy's horses, hacked them to pieces, and threw them into a river or lake, along with all the enemy's weapons and gold. This could be dismissed as myth, if piles of valuable booty had not been recovered from Danish peat bogs, more or less as described. In time, human sacrifice lost its power to confer sanctity on war, or on anything else, for that matter. There is evidence of moral revulsion against human sacrifice among some of the very peoples who are presumed or known to have practiced it. The Aztec pantheon included not only the bloodthirsty warrior god, Huitzilopochtli, but the gentle figure of Quetzalcoatl, who, in some versions of the Aztec mythology, opposes human sacrifice. In Greek mythology, the gods sometimes demand human sacrifice and sometimes punish humans for practicing it. Ambivalence about the rite shows up, for example, in the various literary treatments of Iphigenia's death. In Aeschylus's version, the girl struggles and pleads, making her death so appalling that even the chorus must avert its eyes. But in Euripides' play, she is a willing victim. In fact, less a sacrifice than a suicide. I have been thinking, Mother. Hear me now. I have chosen death. It is my own free choice. The abandonment of human sacrifice has often been taken as evidence that humans are capable of moral progress. But the difference between those who fought wars to capture sacrificial victims and those who fight them for more rational reasons is, in the end, a rather niggling one. War consists of both fighting and killing, which ordinarily go on far from civilians' view. What distinguishes the practitioners of human sacrifice is that they were able to partially separate these two activities. The fighting would go on the battlefield, but at least part of the killing would go on later, far from the battlefield, when the prisoners were sacrificed in public view. It is not that the Aztecs were a particularly bloody-minded people. By European standards, their battles seem to have been rather courteous affairs. But they did believe in separating out part of the killing and saving it up, so to speak, for a spectacular event to be witnessed by all. The use of war to gain sacrificial victims conferred a special religious status on the warriors themselves. But it also served the interests of civilians, who would have had reason to fear a lawless warrior subgroup in their midst.